Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, and welcome to Operation Earth, conversations with comedians about climate change. Hosted by me, Dr. Matt Winning. I've been an environmental researcher for the last decade, and also a stand-up comedian for almost the same amount of time. For years, I used comedy really as an escape in the evenings to stop thinking about how terrible everything was on this planet. But now I think it's time we talk about it, hence this podcast. So in each episode, I speak to a different special guest comedian about what's been happening recently to our planet, what they are doing about it, and any of their worries or questions they have about planet Earth. But it's going to be funny. It's a podcast for anyone who cares about the planet, but probably isn't doing much about it. This is for you.
It's presented by Dr. Matt Winning.
This week's episode is me chatting to Mark Watson, who you probably know from loads of TV stuff. Things like Mock the Week, Have I Got News for You, Never Mind the Buzzcocks, Would I Lie to You, Taskmaster, blah, blah, blah. He's done loads. He's also done loads of stand-up shows. I think he's doing three shows at Edinburgh this year. He's always doing stupid amounts of things. Which is incredibly inspiring to see. He's got a show on tour at the moment called The Infinite Show, which I saw last year, and it's still going because it's infinite, I guess. I don't know. Do check that out. He's also an author, which is incredible. He's written loads of books, one of which was called Crap at the Environment, which is very different to the other books. He's normally done fiction stuff, but he wrote one about 10 years ago about the environment and did a comedy show about it as well. And that was kind of how we originally started chatting a few years ago over a shared worry about climate change and stuff like that. Or I think basically because we both had done some comedy on it and not many people have. Yeah, so this is my conversation with Mark. We recorded it in a little room, so do excuse the sound quality. But yeah, hope you enjoy it. Thanks. I'm with Mark Watson and we're talking about his carbon footprint, which is, we've calculated roughly, you know, this is a rough thing, about 16 tonnes.
I mean, it sounds like a lot for a person.
Which is a lot for a person. So the 2020 target that they've got on this WWF calculator is 10.5 tonnes. So you're not too bad. 163% of your of that target.
Which, yes.
And you took a flight to Australia and back.
Yeah, the trouble is I will normally do that in a year.
Here we go. So there's a breakdown of the 16 tonnes.
Sure enough, travel
and
is
more than half of it is travel.
A massive yellow. That's interesting. If I didn't go to Australia, yep, then my carbon footprint wouldn't be as bad as I thought. Instinctively, it probably was.
Yeah.
But going to Australia is an annual, mostly annual thing for me because of the festival, the Melbourne Festival out there. So it's kind of an important fixture in my life and year. But also, I do love it there. It's one of my favourite, probably is my favourite place to go. So it's quite a stark example of the climate change dilemma, which is, never going to Australia again would be something that would horrify me because I've got friends there, I love it there.
It's a part of your life.
It's part of my life, but it does feel to me like those sorts of changes in people's lives are what we're talking about when we talk about reducing. Like, the amount that flying accounts for a carbon footprint is astonishing to me.
It's crazy.
I mean, because if we absolutely get down to it, we could manage without it. Like, but it would be awful. There'd be loads and loads of terrible consequences for how much we enjoyed our lives.
Yeah,
but it is weird to think that it would be possible to. I imagine if you took the Australia flight out of it, I'd still be over, but there would then be quite a lot of things I could easily do, like light bulbs and, you know, I probably could get in under the target. But it's when you start asking people to not travel, it feels like a fundamental
effect.
A violation of something that people feel they ought to be able
strongly
to do,
about.
Basically.
Yeah, freedom. You're restricting people's freedom in their own
lives. You and I have talked about this before. When you start talking about reducing climate change in terms of what if we didn't do this? People are very resistant to that idea because of the idea of freedom, because we have grown up thinking, I can pretty much do what I want in the Western world, that is, and as middle-class people with some income. You tend to think,
yeah,
it's only in the past 5 years or however long you've been interested in climate change that you've ever heard people say, but what if we didn't do this for the sake of the planet? Yeah. And it's odd because... But,
yeah. It's weird, though, because I guess it comes back to those sort of, you know, like other things like civil rights or other things. It's like freedom is only okay to do if it's not impacting other people.
Absolutely right.
And clearly, yes, it is impacting. It's just that the logical link to who it's impacting,
that is, isn't, yeah, absolutely true. Yeah, the reason that it's difficult to persuade people not to exercise those freedoms is because, as you say, you don't meet any of the people that are directly impacted by you, yeah, taking a flight, and some of them haven't been born yet, and, yeah, so on, and some of them are species that you do not. So those things are very much more difficult for me. But it's really interesting, isn't it? If everybody believed that they were directly impoverishing someone else, even an unborn person, by getting on a plane,
yeah,
in the same way that you accept that if you buy unfairly traded goods or sweatshop clothing, you know, that is damaging people. It's just that you can't, it's very hard to make that link between you taking a plane to Mexico and someone else's actual life getting worse.
Yep.
I think this is a problem we have. I think you talked about it in your show, in fact. For too long, the argument has been, think of the polar bears and think of the ice caps and stuff like that, and people can pretty much live their lives without worrying too much about polar bears.
Yeah. So
if it was, think about, think about 20 million people having nowhere to live, then that's, but even, you can't even do that, can you? Because you just can't comprehend that.
Yeah.
You need it to be, think of this one person who's a child who won't have a home or something, then maybe, you know.
Yeah.
But this is a big problem, I think, with climate change rhetoric is, like, I just saw the comedian Phil Wang talk about this in Melbourne, in fact. He was talking about how going vegan was very likely the best thing to do in a lot of ways, morally and globally and everything. But again, the argument was nearly always, it's cruel to animals, think about animals, which is a good argument, but if you aren't an animal lover, you ultimately don't care about that as much as you care,
yeah,
about your burger, yeah. Whereas if it was go vegan or the planet will be destroyed, then more people would be into that idea.
Yeah.
Every time I think about going vegan or even giving up red meat or vegetarian, it is purely because of the greenhouse gases. I don't.
Yeah, yeah.
I accept that eating animals is probably wrong on loads of levels, but I have been doing it all my life, and I like it.
No,
it's terrible, but you know.
Yeah. No, and I think I'm probably the exact same. Like the way. Just, you know, and it might work for some people. The messaging might work for some people who really care about animals, but you can't use that messaging for everybody. So
it's not enough people that that'll ever be a massive switch. No.
Yeah. Whereas if you talk about the health benefits of changing your diet,
yes,
and having, you know, a really small. So there was a study out this year from the Lancet Commission, which I will probably put in a fact at this point in the podcast, yep, over the top. But they came out with a thing about a planetary diet.
Yeah.
So it's basically if everyone on the planet ate this exact meal
every day
for the rest of time, everybody would benefit in all these ways in terms of health,
yeah,
and people would benefit all these ways in terms of reduced, yeah, emissions, and like the planet would be better.
Yeah,
but and that's a, you know, I don't think it's maybe been made in a way that's got out there into the public,
yeah,
sphere as much, but giving people an exact example of what that meal might be.
Really interesting.
It'd be great.
It's really interesting. What's difficult to understand is 50 years ago, people couldn't fly like they do now anyway.
Yeah.
And I suppose people ate more meat and stuff. We didn't have such a varied diet. But basically, a lot of the freedoms that we're now exercising, we just regard as being part of our humanity. But it's just really a couple of generations that have been able to fly to France or something. You know, it wasn't a thing. None of the things that we think we deserve as humans are actually written into our DNA, yeah, or anything. They're just things that we happen to have now because we were born now.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, the history of human civilization, I'd imagine the number of people who have taken a holiday,
yeah,
somewhere.
Oh, the proportion of people ever born that left the country of their birth would be amazingly low if you could get stats on that,
yeah,
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Because even in this world, like far more people than you think have never been on a plane. So if you look across human history, of course, but you're born thinking that whatever you're born into is the norm. Yeah, and I think that is part of the problem as well.
It is.
it's hard to take things away from people or even ask them to give up things that they've always had. A lot of it is when I look at the people who don't even argue against climate science, but just argue against doing anything about it. The sort of Piers Morgans of the world who are like, well, what, they're going to take this away now? Well, what's the point? An awful lot of it, all you can hear is people saying, but I've lived for 50 years and I've always had these things. I want to still have the things. So much of
The defence of it
is, it's so much of it, to me, feels like people saying, but I like having stuff, though, and I worked hard all my life so I could have this stuff and take these holidays and stuff. Why are you, you know?
Yeah.
Are understandable points of view, but that's not the same as saying, I don't think that we should be doing this.
And I think that's a huge proportion of the population who are maybe not getting reached properly with climate messaging. Because people aren't going beyond, you know. You then, if people come up with that self-defense thing, well, you need to find better ways of talking to them about it.
Well, absolutely, and that's what you're doing, and that's what everyone.
That's what I mean, you did it long before me, Mark.
But not very. It's interesting. I think back to it. So I did these lectures in Al Gore's foundation more than 10 years ago, and it's interesting to try and look back on it now. People were very receptive to the message. It was already a thing, obviously, but I always felt confident I could, as you do, encourage people to say change to a green energy provider or maybe give up meat once a week, or, you know, but it's just when you start asking people to make bigger changes, you know, like, I mean, a green energy provider doesn't even hurt you. It's going to likely to cost you less, and if you do it in 10 seconds, I think a lot
especially
of the problem is that.
We're
all fine with the easy stuff. Even fitting energy saving light bulbs is not a huge ask. It's when it becomes don't go on plane on your holiday or go fully vegan, say, or it's a lot. And for quite a while I've been wondering, will there come a crisis point where either we force people to make lifestyle changes, say by imposing carbon taxes or whatever, but the thing is, it seems like we sort of are at that point. It's just no one really, nothing's changed. That's the weird thing about it. When I was involved in Al Gore's program and stuff, it was 2007-08. He just made the Inconvenient Truth. Yeah. There was a feeling that it was a crisis moment, like a call to immediate action to avert apocalypse. And what's weird 10 years later is, we're still in that moment of crisis, but everyone is still acting like, oh, we should be all right. We could probably hang on in there for another 10 years and then we'll see where we are.
It's quite exhausting, isn't it, for 10 years to talk about a crisis?
Most crises are dealt with within 10 years. It's a really difficult thing about climate change, which it doesn't have in common with really anything else, I don't think.
Yeah.
If there was most humanitarian crises, like famine or something, or gigantic problems, like earthquakes, there is this global call to, like, we need to help, we need to raise £200 million.
Yep.
Any problem that we can globally throw money at, basically, maybe the money gets squandered, the problem doesn't go away, but we can do that. We're good at mobilising ourselves.
Yep.
We're just not good at saying everybody needs to actually change the way they live their lives.
To change our entire society.
We need to change society, yeah.
So that society functions for as long as possibly.
Yeah, as humans, we are much more into, here is a crisis, here is the dramatic action we can take.
Yeah.
I've said this before on stage, like, we have so many narratives about, you know, films, disaster movies are always about aliens want to wipe us out, a meteor is heading for Earth, Nicolas Cage alone can solve this problem. And it's very human that actually this probably is our meteor, this is what's going to do us, but there isn't a hero that can just, there's no dramatic,
there's no hero and there's no real, you know, there's sort of villains, but it's not obvious.
Yeah, it's something very human about it that we always think in terms of someone's out to get us, aliens are going to come, something, or
it's a story.
A story. There are baddies who, if we can repel them, but in this story, we're sort of the baddies and we don't like that as humans.
That's right, listeners. Each and every single one of you
is a baddie,
but also the hero.
Yes, the potential hero.
Potential hero.
We can all be Nicolas Cage.
Yes.
Well, Nicolas Cage himself, cannot become any more
Nicolas Cage. No,
he is at maximum Nicolas Cage.
100% Nicolas Cage.
Jesus, Nicolas Cage.
I mean, sometimes you see him in a film and you think, well, that is even more Nicolas Cage than I thought Nicolas Cage could possibly be.
All of us have moments where we wake up and we think, I can't really remember how I got here or who I am. And, you know, but I reckon for Nicolas Cage, he is solidly,
every day.
Is always himself.
Have you seen the film with him in it with Cher? It's like, oh, I can't remember what it is.
I already think the answer is no, because I think I'd remember.
You'd remember that.
Seen that. Yeah.
It is one of the most mental performances. It's like he's very young and he's lost like a hand or something. And he's a baker. And the introduction scene...
Yeah, I don't believe I have seen this now.
It is one of the most wonderful things I have
really
ever seen in my life, his performance in that film. And he plays like the sort of... I'm sure it's Cher. Yeah, I went through a stage of watching Cher films.
That much is clear from what you're saying. Yeah, I'm not going to question your motives. That's what happened.
It was Mermaids, and then there was another one. The film was called Moonstruck. I can't believe I didn't remember what the film was called. So annoying.
Nicolas Cage has been a digression here.
Yeah, sorry. So let's quickly go back to personal stuff on you, and then we'll jump on to some other things. You tour a lot.
Yeah.
Do you find it quite hard to make that assist? Like you said, you eat at a lot of, like, you're eating out a lot.
Yeah, there's no doubt that touring is a bad lifestyle for making long-lasting lifestyle changes, because it's not your real lifestyle. You're aware that you're sort of... I mean... I'll eat in restaurants or in hotels or basically wherever I can get fed for half the week.
I got off stage last night and had a hot dog straight after. And I try not to eat meat as much as possible, but I...
Sometimes it's not possible.
And I was just like, I'm here, I'm really hungry, I'm more exhausted than I felt for as long as I can remember.
This is another problem, I think. You do tend to gravitate towards comfort food, easy stuff.
Yeah.
And often on tour, you don't have the familiar things around you. So you make choices which make you feel better immediately, like a hot dog or a curry.
It's to keep your motivation, to keep your energy, and keep your sort of happiness up when you're at a time where you're out of your comfort zone.
But this is the thing, isn't it? There's excuses like that forever if you want them. To be fair to us, if you had a 9-to-5 job and you knew exactly what time you were getting home every evening, if you're the sort of person that can plan a week's meals and go and do a shop for those week's meals, then you could make some headway on your carbon footprint quite quickly.
Yeah.
But I can't remember the last time I had a week where I was planning 7 meals ahead like that. 7 dinners ahead. Tipping points.
Tipping points. Environmental tip of the week. Share a bath with your parents. Environmental tip of the week. Tipping points.
Let's move on to a news story, which is about chips. Are you a big fan of chips?
Actually, I'm not a huge chips man. I mean, I do eat them, obviously, but...
But you're not...
I wouldn't just get a bag of chips or something.
I was never really into chips until quite recently. And I think... I don't know what it is. I've hit an age where all of a sudden fish and chips has now become one of my favourite things. And it wasn't for a long time. I don't know if it's like you get a lot of good stuff in Scotland. I think maybe I miss it and it feels like some sort of connection to...
Actually, if I can get chips with curry sauce or something like you often get in Scotland, I will go for that. That's probably my favourite
iteration of chips. I mean, whoever came up with that blending...
It's a genius, and I hope he's now a millionaire.
I don't know if you can trademark chips and curry sauce. So the story is about how Britain's chips are under threat due to climate change because of unpredictable weather. And basically, last year, the potato snack chips was about an inch shorter on average because in 2018, the heat waves robbed the soils of the water that the chips would use. You said you're not a huge chip fan. Do you care about the size of your chips?
I don't think I'm a person that would look at a bunch of chips and say, these seem an inch shorter on average than I was hoping. I'd be,
I mean, the thing is, small chips, I find them quite disappointing.
I mean...
If I get a small... It's a lot of effort to keep piling chips in your mouth.
No, I know what you mean.
And if you're going to get some curry sauce, you want to be dipping...
That's true, actually.
If you're a sizable chip into
garlic, I like
sauce.
A garlic mayo as well. I like to dip chips in things. So yes. Then you are looking for length. You're right. Otherwise, the dipping becomes non-starter.
You can dip stuff. I didn't even think about this.
No, but no.
The dip industry is going to be affected by this.
The dipping culture is going to be wrecked if there's another couple of hot summers. Yeah.
Condiments, Hellman's, mate, all these people, you know, ketchup.
If I'm making aioli right now, I'm thinking, I hope chips remain as long as they currently are. Otherwise,
we're done for.
Yeah, God. This is the thing. Everything has consequences for more people than this.
I think we are probably the first people to think of this.
We are. We've hit on a very important consequence of climate change that has not even been discussed yet.
Not even Heinz have thought of this yet. And now they're hearing this and they're going, oh God, we need to really do something about it. This was another thing on top of this was, I'll maybe cover this in another story, was about beer prices. So basically, barley harvests are going to reduce a lot in the future. And most of the barley gets used for animal feed. So if we keep eating and increasing the amount of meat that we're having,
we can't also have beer.
We can't also have beer.
Whoa.
And the choice is meat or beer.
That's a Hobson's choice, isn't it? Whatever the phrase is.
Would you want more meat or beer?
Now, I'm a wine drinker, so I can manage without beer, but presumably there's consequences for the wine.
Although,
surely grape harvests will also go to hell.
I think they will, and they'll need more water.
You can't make wine without a healthy climate. There's wines or grapes that thrive in drier climates, I don't think any of them thrive in desert conditions.
Most of the grape places are on quite hot. You know, you're talking about South Africa,
Australia, California,
places that are going to really get affected by this.
Yeah, and in fact, in Australia, I went to a winery last month during my during my festival time there, and this guy was saying, the bloke that ran a winery in just outside Melbourne in Victoria, was saying, we've always grown a particular type of grapes. I think it was maybe Chardonnay type grapes or something. But anyway, he was saying we have switched to this type of grape because we reckon we'll be a degree hotter in 10 years' time, and we need to factor that in. And I think if you live somewhere like Australia, the Aussies do talk about it much more because it's already hot there. So a couple of extra degrees there and there's bushfires or wineries don't produce. The consequences in a country like that are quite visible.
It's already really hot.
I often think that. The times I've been to Australia, if you live in a warm enough climate, you don't have trouble persuading people that more heat is a problem because it is a killer, potentially. They deal with that. Part of our problem, although it seems ridiculous, like such a stereotype, it seems like a hack joke, but it's true, it's often not very warm here. So we do all fall into the trap of thinking, oh, it's lovely how hot it is here. Yeah. But Australians don't do that. Yeah. They don't want it to be hotter than
the office. They're like, we've got enough.
Yeah.
No more hoys. Yeah, I guess that's a really good point. The UK is actually supposed to be one of the biggest benefits of climate change because things are moving. You know, what would have grown in southern France or middle France will now get grown in England. And all of a sudden you're going to have loads of English wines.
Yes, I think you had a joke about this in your show, didn't you? About how Brexit doesn't matter because we'll essentially be the same as France.
We're going to be French very soon.
That's a great example of the how insular you can get as a society, thinking, well, we're all right, we're going to have slightly more strawberries.
Doesn't matter, screw the rest of them.
Put the news off, eat the strawberries, and put your fingers in your ears,
Wimbledon, there's lots of strawberries, they're bigger than ever.
Yeah, they'll be all right, those guys, with their £15 punnets of strawberries.
So the chips, we've come across something which I don't think anyone's thought about,
And the chips it was a good discussion to have because I instinctively think I don't care that much about chips, but you start talking about how you can't dip them in things and that is a problem, and as we've said, that's a good example of how you don't always think through the consequences of everything.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
You will have heard about these ideas like carbon credits systems and things, and where ultimately each individual would be sort of limited in terms of what they could. You could either have a holiday or you can have...
Yeah.
Do you think we're at a point of climate emergency where some sort of dramatic, massively unpopular legislation is going to have to happen? Or do you think we can still pull it back with smaller scale action?
Well, I think it's really coming into focus now, this sort of question.
It feels like it is now. Yeah. We have to work this out quite soon now.
Yeah, and I think to me, it feels like there's two separate kind of solutions being put forward. Mm-hmm. And one is that we do it in 10 years, and one is that we do it over the course of 30 years.
Yeah.
Right?
And I've seen you talking about this. Yeah, like petitioning, like 30 years is surely too long, right? Because
It is, but as long, but I just mean in terms of actually achieving the final sort of goal. So 30 years is too long if we did nothing about it.
Okay,
but if you're gonna, you could do everything we need to do. You could try and do it
brutally,
exactly,
or
slightly less painful
years.
Way, yeah, and right. Do it over 30 years. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the to me that feels like the point that people are now arguing about.
Yeah,
and it depends. Either of those has to happen. One of those has to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
And so whoever's going to win that argument of what has to happen, we need to have that debate right now.
Right now.
And then if it's 10 years, it's going to be fairly brutal.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to replace every car in the UK will have to be replaced.
Yeah.
And every boiler in the UK will have to be replaced. You know,
so it's looking like the 30 years is... Politically, it's much easier to do that, isn't it?
Exactly. But even then, it's not that much time. So that would be roughly what you would have to do is the suggestion is that you would have to ban all new petrol and diesel cars by 2030, say. So in 10 years.
Which is, your petition?
Yes, I had a petition last year. And actually,
that does seem possible to me.
I think so.
I don't know about the manufacture of electric cars. I don't know how many we can make, but it doesn't seem impossible to.
But it gives at least enough time for companies to go, okay, some time to do this.
Yeah.
And then there's the 20 years after that to be like, okay, so every new car has to be electric beyond 2030.
Yes.
And we've put in the infrastructure
that if we started now, I would think.
Yeah. And then you would, all the cars that come off the road would then obviously have to be replaced. You could only replace them by light, and it depends how much you script. But either, that's just one part of like the whole problem would be, say, transport.
You've
cars.
Still got planes.
There's still everything else that you have to deal
and
with.
And also, even while we're talking about this, there's a new Heathrow runway coming. there's no sign that the aviation industry will be slowed down anytime soon.
No. And that's, you know, and that's government. So the other question is like, we now need to make governments make decisions that are consistent with what they're saying. So you can't say, we need to do stuff about climate change.
Climate change is a huge priority.
It needs to be so far up the list that you can't then open another runway.
You would think we were already at that point. Yeah. Like, I don't see how the case for a third runway at Heathrow can be stronger than the case for keeping the planet going. I mean, I know it's not quite that stark, but
it's
a lot more planes coming in and out of Heathrow surely isn't a step forward.
Well, I mean, it's definitely not the solution, and it's business as usual. It's continuing the way we are just now, and not as
And at times like that, you do sort of, despair is not the word, but you do worry because you can't help thinking Heathrow is already massive. I understand the need for business, for infrastructure, obviously I understand the need for planes too, but keeping Heathrow at the size it is, having the number of flights we already
have,
is
a
problem.
Yeah.
So it feels amazing to me that we can have had a long debate over whether we should make Heathrow much bigger.
Should we make this problem worse?
A debate which has ended in saying, "Yeah, all right." Stuff like that makes you think.
Yeah.
Well, businesses and government can say as much as they want about climate change being a priority, but that feels like an enormous move towards. And you just wonder whether that is going to keep happening.
Yeah.
Government. Talking about it, but not really.
It can't keep happening.
It just can't, right? Like, it can't.
Yeah.
I mean,
and it has been for, 20 years, 30 years.
I mean, if you look at the difference that my one flight to Australia made on the carbon footprint, increasing the size of Heathrow by a third, I mean, it doesn't, you can't think about it. It's,
yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? So that's the kind of, I think, stage we're at. Where either it has to be...
Well, there have to be some political measures now in place, but it's just about the time scale that
exactly,
we choose.
Yes.
So, and do you think if it was 30 years, it is still possible to avert the damage that we're... Or,
I think we'll probably,
because it feels like that's what will happen.
Yeah.
The world's governments will collectively do stuff which is good, but not quite too damaging to anyone. Yeah.
So I think we'd end up hitting something, if we did that, we'd, and the rest of the world roughly followed suit.
Yeah.
Just that, because it's also about whether the UK, given that the UK is responsible for historically, like a huge, I'll add in something here, but I think historically the UK's certainly was responsible for most of the emissions across the world for a long time, and still,
and even now we're punching above our weight for the size we are. Yeah,
exactly.
The UK is actually responsible between the years 1850 and 2007 for around 5.8% of all emissions that had ever occurred. And if you do it on a per capita basis, the UK was the second highest country emitting per capita, just behind Luxembourg.
And then it's whether we want to be leading the world. So we have done bits really well over the last while, but we've not kept pushing it.
Yeah.
We've sort of patted ourselves on the back for being like, oh, we've put this legislation in and we've started reducing this thing, and now it's like, well, either we keep on that path or we go even further and show the world how to do this.
Yeah.
Well,
unfortunately, the problem with it is, and we've had this discussion before as well.
Sure.
It's not a sexy subject, and so to make positive changes, you have to. Like, that thing of patting ourselves on the back is so true, which is very British, and it's also just very human to be like, right, well, we've done that, we've got a building now which is carbon neutral, so that's pretty good. The trouble with this is you have to keep making changes that no one will give you credit, a pat on the back for. I think that's
we like a pat on the back.
We really like,
we don't really have enough time to keep
to go vegan for the sake of the planet.
Yeah.
You'd want someone every day to say, this is amazing what you're doing.
Yes.
But what we need is to do these things without any congratulation, to do it because it's the right thing. And that again comes back to this thing of, if we could save the planet by collectively fighting off aliens, then we will, because we'll all feel good about it.
Yeah.
But a lot of the stuff we need to do now, you don't even feel that good about it. I mean, you're doing it because you have to do it. And that is not an easy sell, is it?
It's not an easy sell.
And that's why I sometimes think we're just going to need to pass a series of laws to... Yeah. I mean, if I was prohibited by law from flying to Australia, or if it was like...
Once a year.
You can do it once a year.
Say once every 5 years.
Yeah, and there was a quota, then I would find that very upsetting, but I would do it. But I'd be like, well, this law has been passed because otherwise there is a catastrophe. It is theoretically possible to reach Australia over land. Like, if you leave enough time, I would find ways around it.
Yeah.
Or anything like that. If overnight red meat became unavailable because it was right for us not to eat it, I'd be pissed off. But again, I would be like, all right, what else am I going to do then? Yeah. And I think loads of people would. I'm not advocating big government stroke totalitarianism in most areas, but I sometimes do think we might have to just
go for it.
Pass some incredibly unpopular laws and then see how we adapt as a society.
Yeah. I mean, I've always said, I think the major hope that we have, right? Well, I say a major hope. One aspect is that China is like basically the biggest polluter in the world.
Yeah.
But also China has a government which can do things.
Yes.
Very quickly if it wants to.
They can get results. Yeah.
Results-based industry. And actually, if they decided, okay, we're just going to do this.
Yeah.
They could do it very quick, in a much quicker than perhaps we could do it.
Yes, the Chinese government are able to get in their way a lot of the time,
get
shall
way
we
to,
say.
Yeah, a little bit of power residing there, which is not a reason for much hope, but also it shows you that if you do have more strict laws or whatever or decisions, then actually you can achieve things very
much quicker. I never thought I'd be a person that would be saying things like, well, all we need is just tougher laws and things, like some sort of Daily Mail reader.
Except
not like a Daily Mail reader, because they would say we need tougher laws on some things, but definitely not this. But I do, as I... feels like an uncharitable thing to say, but I'm only saying it because I include myself in it. There is an argument. People will just not do this stuff on a big enough scale unless there are laws come in which say, and it doesn't have to be laws, like you can't fly, you can't have spaghetti bolognese.
Yeah.
But perhaps if there were laws which forced you to stay below a certain threshold carbon-wise, you'd find a way of doing it.
Yeah. But also I think the argument that people make is that they won't do it themselves because other... like, well, I can do this, but what? You know, it doesn't matter.
That's the other thing.
So if there's a law in place, then it means you go, well, everyone has to do this.
That's the
thing. I'm much more willing to accept the fact that my next door neighbour also has to.
And that's true, and that's human nature. Yeah. If I prohibited myself from eating red meat because of the planet, I'd be furious that everyone else wasn't.
Yeah.
Sometimes you do think, but if we were all in the same boat. The trouble, I suppose, is that if you're a politician... I don't even really blame them. They've got to try to get re-elected.
Yeah.
And politicians will always make decisions which they think will be popular.
Yeah.
And there's no way this can be done in a popular way,
I don't think. I think we've just stumbled across the answer, which is we need politicians that don't want to get re-elected.
Yeah, we need politicians who genuinely do want to have 4 years in office
and
where they do some good and then disappear forever.
And go and do something else. Those are the people we need.
Yeah. Which almost is possible if you got someone who was in charge... like who was a kind of maverick figure who was just like, I'm going to be Prime Minister and you're going to do what I say for 4 years and then you will never see me again. That's what
we need.
Gone. But unfortunately, because of our party system, if you were in charge, if you were the leader of the Conservative Party and you started doing this, you'd be deposed within 3 weeks. That's the problem. While political parties exist, it is hard for people to pass unpopular laws because there's 20 people in their ear going, but we'll lose votes now. We'll, you know... it makes you think we should dissolve all the political parties and just vote in some dude every time as Prime Minister. Or, you know.
Everybody has to stand for 4 years.
Every single person has to be... like with jury duty, you might have to be Prime Minister at some point. If you were voted in, you cannot say no to it. You have to be in charge.
Yeah. That'd be great. I think everybody would just be... You'd get a letter through the post.
Christ, I'm Prime Minister. Right.
Okay, I better get thinking of some ideas.
Right, I'll have a think.
Yeah. And then you just end up with some person that's really, like, I don't know, into some conspiracy theory about flight. And then all
that
of a sudden...
That is the problem, you'd have to filter it a bit.
Yes. Yeah, there'd be some sort of check system in place. And
our current political system is not very good for identifying the right people to run the country, but a completely random choice is also not the way to go, I think.
Yeah,
so we need somewhere in between that.
Something in between random and... self-selecting narcissists.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
it's what we're at.
But what political system that would be, nobody yet knows.
No, we've not. You know, we've not come across it. Great. Well, thanks very much. Anything else you want to?
No, I think basically I'll just go away and have a think now, as usual after these discussions.
Yeah, it's always nice to have a
think. But like, even now, I'm gonna have to eat. I would like a pizza.
Yeah,
and I probably am gonna go for a meat topping even after this discussion. That's the thing. But if I went out there and the law had changed in the past hour and it said there's
pepperoni
only vegetarian food, then
I'd
adapt, I'd find a way. I think I am a good example of a sort of well-meaning but not very strong-willed citizen.
Yeah.
So I would welcome laws that forced me to do stuff. It's not a very popular point of view, but I think I would.
I'm sure there's lots of similar people out there.
Tell me what I'm not allowed and I'll do it.
I don't want to get in trouble.
I'm a conformist. I'm not a rebel against it.
Got you. Great. Anything you'd like to plug?
Well, I'm on tour almost constantly. So if you want to see a guy who's hungry on stage, as we've discussed,
if you want to see a hungry man doing comedy,
someone that, and I'll always give 100% on stage. I never kind of slack off or anything. But there can't be a comedian that hasn't had at least 10% of his brain going, I wonder what I will have after this thing.
Yeah.
The good thing is, if you're experienced enough, you can still be 100% in the show and your brain does that by itself. I never get distracted by thoughts of food. I'm just aware there's a department in my brain that is permanently calculating where the next meal is.
A good insight there into the minds of hunger.
Any comedian you watch,
it's
not that they're not concentrating or that they don't care about the audience, but a little bit of them is thinking about where dinner is going to come from and what it will be.
During that big laugh.
During the big laugh, yeah. The bigger the laugh, yeah, if you watch McIntyre or someone on TV, I guarantee you, when there's a minute of applause, yeah, that minute, if he's got any sense, he's thinking, nah.
What am I having after
I've Googled
this?
Various places around here.
Oh, there was a nice Italian around the corner.
Yeah, it's human nature. Because we're always on at 7.30 or 8.
Yeah.
You go on stage at the... I don't have a sport act or anything. Yeah, no, yeah. I'm normally on from 7, like 8 to 10. You can't really eat before, not relax. So basically, yeah, we're working at people's dinner time. So what are you going to do?
And then you get a bag of chips. You can't dip.
Bag of chips, you know? They're tiny. You can't even see them.
What are you going to do? Okay, so go and see Mark on tour. Thanks very much for coming on.
Pleasure.
Having a chat.
I'll just sort of leave now.
Yeah, well, I think that's the best idea. But, it's good. Mark and I, are the only two people I know. Actually, no, there's a couple of other people that have talked about climate change.
Yeah, Marcus Brigstock.
Marcus Brigstock as well. But, you know, you and
it,
I are the only ones...
It remains an unfashionable topic for comedy. Oh, Laura Lex as well.
Oh, yeah,
Laura.
She's quite interesting. Yeah. I think it's going to become more of a thing, isn't it?
I hope so, yeah.
So what I want to tell people is, this. You know, Mark started all of this... You know.
I think it is important. Comedians have to talk about it because humans have to talk about it.
Exactly.
But there's only just enough jokes about it to cover us, really. So I don't know how we're going to manage.
So don't bother doing it anymore. Yeah,
don't do new comedy about it, if you don't mind.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure.
So that was my conversation with Mark Watson. He's a very thoughtful, lovely man to chat to. You can see him at the Edinburgh Festival this year doing a work-in-progress show at the Stand Comedy Club. I think it's at 1 something in the afternoon. You can also see me there as well. I'm doing a show, Matt Winning, It's the End of the World as We Know It, which is on at the Pleasance Courtyard at 4:25 p.m. Tickets on my website, mattwinning.com. There's other shows there as well. If you do want to get in contact with us about the podcast, you can at operationearth@gmail.com. We're also at OpEarthPod on Twitter and Facebook. And the show was produced and edited by Emma Corsham. All the music by the composer Daniel Drever, and the design and logo was done by Chum Chi Design, and it was listened to by yourself. I hope you're back next week.